The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
Thank you for joining us today in the Anomic Age. I'm your host, John Age. We have a great show for you yet again today, but before we get into any of that, please check out AnomicAge.com. Share that link with your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies, everyone in between. Share it with those masked fools at the stores, if you will. If you could do this, which I don't have a mask for the Anomic Age, I thought about it. But you can just write Anomic Age on your little silly paper mask and wear it all out and about. If you do so, send me some pics. I'd be happy to see that. But nevertheless, share those links. Word of mouth is the best way to go because it can't be censored. Well, it can, but not that easily quite yet. So if nothing else, just share the show. Talk to people. Tell them, hey, here's this guy on the internet. It's great. It's refreshing. It's truthful. It's called AnomicAge.com. The John Age Project. Propagating truth in a world of lies. So share that any way you can. I put up a new show last night in the information breakdown portion of the page. So if you haven't checked that out yet, why not? Go ahead and do so. We got all the links working for all the social media. We have the Facebook. We have the Twitter. No, excuse me. We don't have Twitter anymore. It's gone. They kicked me off there in December. I'm still thinking about getting back on there in some sort of alias fashion just so I can communicate with peoples that have no other form of communication as far as trying to get guests and things of that nature. But make no mistake about it, not on Twitter anymore. Facebook, yes. YouTube, absolutely. Brighteon, certainly. And BitChute. We're on BitChute now, too. I'm thinking about Vimeo as well. I just haven't made the effort to do that quite yet. But we're on all of the other aforementioned social media sites. And as far as the daily operation of the show, perhaps the most important, the Patreon and the PayPal links there on the mid-right. Patreon link, you can make it a regular thing. PayPal link, you can just do it a one-time deal if you'd like. PayPal.me/AnomicAge. You can donate directly right now. $5 would be awesome. Even more, even better. Because I keep getting the bills. I got another one today for server space and other goodies. So the bills don't stop, folks. So if you are so inclined, please donate to the program. Also, we have at the very bottom of the page, you can sign up for the newsletter. I encourage you to do that as well. But if nothing else, your thoughts, your prayers, your well wishes are always welcome. You can email me from the homepage of AnomicAge.com too. And tons of guests. An amazing amount of very awesome guests. And we got another one coming at you today. Today I'm pretty excited about this show. Not that I'm not always excited about the show, because I am. But certain topics are very much in my wheelhouse and sort of harken back to a lot of those things that really got me interested in such things in the first place. Today we're going to talk with the author of I'm from the Government and I'm Here to Kill You, The True Human Cost of Official Negligence, Mr. David T. Hardy. So I got the mind and the opinion that if you don't know your history, you're going to be doomed to repeat it. And I think that's exactly what the heck we're doing. So for whatever reason, it's difficult to get people to talk about a lot of this 90s stuff. I don't know if it's the really shortened memory that everybody has. We got about 8 seconds now. So if people are just like, oh, the 90s, that was like 2,000 years ago. We don't even need to know about that anymore. But we do. So I'm very happy to speak to Mr. Hardy in just a mere matter of moments. So if you will hold on to your hats and stick around, we'll join him on the other side and get into some very dark side of the Force with Waco. Stick around. It is my pleasure to welcome into the Anomic Age today, Mr. David T. Hardy. David graduated in 1972 with a BA from University of Arizona and went on to graduate with a degree in law in 1975 from Arizona also. Both of those are with honors, by the way. He's had 10 years governmental service, Interior Department, Washington, D.C., 33 years in private practice, experience ranged from Endangered Species and Administrative Procedure Acts to death penalty reversal in the Arizona Supreme Court, and a 5-4 in the U.S. Supreme Court. 26 law review articles authored, 2 cited by the U.S. Supreme Court, and 1 by 11 U.S. Circuit Courts of Appeals, and another by Larry Tribe's American Constitutional Law. Author of 5 books, 1 a New York Times bestseller. Wow. Quite a bit. Thank you so much, David, for being on the program.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Indeed. You don't know how excited, I guess that's probably not the right word, because the topics we're discussing aren't anything to be glorified or celebrated, but it's so good to talk to someone about these things, because for me, I grew up, graduated high school in the 90s, but like so many folks in high school, probably just didn't have that sense of what was going on at the time. I was focused on girls and skateboarding and music and silly stuff like that. But when you look back at this material, and I've done so much just looking back at what was going on in the 90s, I kind of see that as such a pivotal decade as far as where we are today, because so much of what was going on then really gets lost in the mosh, so to speak. Everybody's still at least interested in the JFK assassination, and then they sort of flip forward to 9/11 and forget that a lot happened between those two events. But one of those, most specifically, is the events that happened in Waco, the 51-day siege. And, well, you've done a little bit on that, so that's why you're here. I'm so excited.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
I actually have a Facebook page devoted to this book. And if you go there, it's got audio and video from the Waco siege, some stuff that hasn't generally been reported, such as the soundtrack from the infrared tapes as the helicopter was circling the burning building. And the soundtrack picked up FBI radio traffic, things like that. You know, there was a whole lot that went on in that place.
I mean, that's so pivotal. I mean, the FLIR footage is one thing, but I didn't realize there was audio tracks now available as well. That's going to be pretty interesting. I guess we should start out with kind of what got you interested in this. There was so much going on that decade in itself. You had Ruby Ridge, you had Waco, you had Oklahoma City bombing, you had World Trade bombing 1, Columbine. I mean, there was so much. So much that I think sort of shaped the way that we perceive and react to many of the events that have gone on since then. But Waco just being the kind of, I won't say the biggest one, but it lasted the longest. So it sort of garnered the public eye for the longest period of time. What got you interested in that and really delving into this huge debacle?
I'm trying to remember. I think it was a friend of mine, Mike McNulty, that got me interested. Mike died a few years ago. He was producing at that time a movie called Waco, the Rules of Engagement. It was a first-rate movie and went on to be nominated for an Oscar in the documentary category. So he and William Gusecki and Dan Gifford were working on that film. Did a professional job, but that sort of got me interested, and then I started doing some Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits. And the government agencies were patently lying. I mean, lying to the point of stupidity. And that sort of got me stirred up. And so I kept on pressing ahead with the Freedom of Information Act suits. And in the end, won them, and they handed over literally about a cubic yard of video and audio tapes together with a bunch of documents. And to give you some idea of the documents, one of them was, well, to back up, for weeks before the first day's raid, the shootout with BATF, BATF had some undercover agents in a house across from the Davidian house, since we're in the countryside, we're talking a couple hundred yards away, but facing the Davidian's house, and they were supposed to be observing. And supposedly, nobody could arrest David Koresh, the leader, peacefully, because supposedly he was a paranoid recluse who never left the Davidian building. Well, one of the documents had to cough up told what the agents in the undercover house had done a week before the big bloody shootout. They weren't shooting with David Koresh. I'm not kidding. This is an ATF's own document. They went over there, knocked on the door, and this man who supposedly could never be lured out of the building said that they wanted to go shooting with their AR-15s in the open land behind the Davidian place. And David Koresh said, hey, I've got a bunch of ammo for those. Can I come with you? And they said, well, yeah. And so they went out there. They had all the guns. Koresh was carrying the ammunition. Mm-hmm. Okay. This was the man they supposedly could never get out of the building so they could peacefully arrest him. They're out there snapping caps with him. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But here's the ATF's own official report on that day.
Yeah, that's kind of the accounts I heard also. I mean, I heard that he would sort of jog outside the compound and go out and walk and exercise. And I'm thinking, man, he couldn't have just pulled up in a police car and probably said, hey, could you come talk to us for a minute? I mean,
yeah, well, that's what the sheriff said. He said if they told him, he would have just called over. You know, he and Koresh talked all the time. He would have just called him up and said, hey, they got a warrant for you. Come and turn yourself in. So, yeah.
Well, what was the issue with the firearms? Because, I mean, that was sort of the original grudge that ATF had on this thing, that he was selling or changing firearms to be fully auto and all this and that. And from what I'd researched on this, it seemed to be kind of hogwash. It seemed like he had a legitimate business, if you, for lack of a better term. He was selling legal and lawful firearms at gun shows and so forth. So, anybody that has a business, you're going to have a lot. If you're selling socks, you know, you're going to have a lot of socks somewhere to sell the socks. So, I mean,
well, I don't know that they were selling, they were buying them. And one of them later told the FBI it was for investment. I've got to say, you know, at that point, AR-15s were going for $400. So, yeah, these guys needed no investment advisor there. They were going to make a mint.
Certainly.
And, what the to get the warrant, ATF claimed that they had fully automatic weapons. Well, the grounds for the warrant stunk. I mean, the evidence consisted of some guy nearby said he heard the sound of fully automatic fire coming from their vicinity. Oh, okay. Who was it? Was it somebody they let come on their land? Was it a neighbor? Did the guy who was firing have a federal permit to own it? So that's not probable cause to, you know, bash in a door and search a place. You need more than that.
Yeah, that's hearsay at best.
Yeah.
And I mean, that seems to parallel a lot of what we got going on now with the red flag gun laws, where anybody can just say, hey, you know, I heard David's got an operational tank in his backyard shooting off rockets or something.
Yeah.
No proof, no video, no nothing, but they're going to come storm your door down just like they did then.
Oh, yeah. And that was the other thing. They plainly didn't anticipate a fight. This was a big PR effort. Mm-hmm. Their House Appropriations hearings were coming up, and the agency needed to grab the headlines. And this was going to be it. They didn't think there was going to be a fight. A lot of the agents I checked, and a lot of the agents went into action with only one spare magazine for their pistol or sometimes their rifle. One guy went in with his M16, and only the 30-round clip in it was the only ammunition he had. This wasn't going to be a fight. It's going to be big, dramatic. Helicopters swoop down. It seems dangerous, but in the end, they were just going to execute the warrant. And actually, if it wasn't for something at the back of the building, that might just have been reality. The firefight started at the back of the building, not the front. It spread around to the front, but it was started in the back. And the question is, was it shots from the agents' helicopters approaching or shots at the helicopters? I think there were shots going both ways, but I think the ones from the helicopter came first. Only then did it spread around the front. Out in front, David Koresh is running out of the building, waving his hands, saying there are women and children here. He's trying to defuse the situation. And then all of a sudden, at the back of the building, you get bang, 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 bang. And he realizes everybody's going to empty their magazine now. And he starts to run back for the cover. And at that point, he's hit. And then after he gets through the door, he's hit again. The thing is, he was trying to stop a fight, not cause one.
It just seems so insane, because I've seen the same material, not as you, I'm sure, but a lot of that same stuff. And it seemed to be exactly what you said. It seems like, oh, it's time for budget again. We got to go out with a bang, pun intended, I guess. And I can't recall the lady's full name, but I believe it was Wheeler, was one of the ATF agents that was going ahead and calling the media and like, hey, we're coming on. We're going to do a warrant. And we're going full tactical. We got all of our guns and, you know, everything you can fit on the rifle and full body armor and everything else. But, I mean, like you said, the big issue was they didn't think they were going into a fight, apparently, because they ran out of ammo. And thankfully, I guess, for those agents, they agreed to a truce so they could retreat and not get fired upon. Because if the Branch Davidians really wanted to snuff out the situation, they say, oh, well, you guys got no ammo. We're just going to gun you down.
Oh, sure. You know, the 911 tapes were fascinating because they are mostly Wayne Martin, who was the Davidian's attorney, actually practiced law out there. Mm-hmm. He's immediately on the line to 911 and shouting, as I recall, something about there are 70 some number, 75 people around their building, and they're shooting at us out at Mount Carmel. Make them stop. And so all that chaos goes on, but from the first moments of the shootout, the Davidians are asking for a ceasefire. And eventually it does take place, but the 911 center doesn't have any contact information for the ETF agents. So in the end, they radio a university squad car, and the university policeman drives up to ATF raid headquarters, and that's the only way they can establish the link to the Davidians who are asking for a ceasefire.
That just seems insane that there's so much communication breakdown that the folks on 911's end should have been able just to call up ATF and say, hey, guys, women and children inside, they want a ceasefire. Let's just peacefully de-escalate. We'll get everybody to walk out and call it a day, you know?
Yeah. But there was no link. They had to contact this local policeman to do it. And then there were some sort of negotiations that went back and forth. And some of those there were things like, at one point, a Davidian fires a shot. And it turns out that he's been inside and he's been deafened by the gunfire. I mean, you're shooting in a confined space with no hearing protection. So he didn't hear the command to stop firing. But eventually everything's taken care of and the agents are free to pick up their wounded, which was their term, and withdraw. And during the withdrawal, I've got the video also, they... A news cameraman was filming in front of them with his camera up to his face, walking backward. And, you know, guys coming out of a firefight, their adrenaline is running just a bit high. Mm-hmm. Well, they beat him up. I mean, you know, you're carrying your own wounded away, and here's this news guy walking backward in front of you. And apparently somebody just decided they'd had a little too much and they popped him a few times.
They shot the news guy?
Oh, no, didn't shoot him. They hit him.
Fist. Okay.
Yeah. Goodness. Some fists and cussing.
I got you. Jeez. Yeah. That's not much better, but at least I didn't shoot him, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, considering everything that went down, that was sort of the phase one of the program. Mm-hmm. And then, from my perspective, once ATF kind of got it handed to them, then they called in reinforcements, and it really really just escalated almost exponentially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When they called in the FBI, I had it from a guy who was teaching in town at Baylor University, that FBI hostage rescue team came in there, so they're hyper macho Delta types, and that there were fights in the motels because you'd have ATF agents there and the FBI agents there. And it was sort of the ATF was conscious that FBI is sort of, hey, get out of our way. Now it's time for us professionals. And apparently some of the guys were settling it out in the hallways. You know, somebody mouthed off a little too much and you'd have two agents beating the heck out of each other. But then the FBI came in and did everything wrong, just about everything wrong. I mean, the bottom line was Koresh was coming out on the day he was about to come out on the day they raided him. And what got through to him wasn't the hostage rescue team or negotiators. What got through to him was a couple of theologians, I mean, professors of theology, who are interested in religions of that look forward to the end of the world. I don't know how you pronounce it. They had actually looked at the Davidian religion, and they solved the puzzle, which was, how do you surrender given your religious beliefs and this is what's going to happen in the future? How does your surrender fit in with that? If it fits in, we surrender. And so these guys went on a radio program that they knew the Davidians listened to, and essentially demonstrated that if you take the Davidian view of scripture, of duty, right now it's actually your duty to surrender, not to hold out. And their Koresh immediately began sending out things to the effect of that obviously he'd listened to the broadcast, and he was writing up a quote-unquote little book, which has scriptural, to explain his view of things, and that when that was done, he would turn himself over for judgment. Okay, problem is about to be solved. He's not the fastest writer in the world, so probably another week, they estimated. So they pumped a place full of tear gas and stormed it anyway.
Wow, so if they would have just stuck around for a little bit and let things sort of de-escalate from the full five-alarm fire to a calm, then we could have probably not had all these men, women, and children just murdered like this.
Sure. You know, when they went in, there was a civil suit after this, and I was in the room when they took the deposition of, I think it was Danny Colson, who founded the FBI hostage rescue team. My personal impression is if they'd left Danny Colson in charge of it, no one would have died. That is beyond the first day's casualties. Because, yeah, he was aggressive, but a wise man too, and his successor was just aggressive. And the infrared video from above showing tanks actually crashing into the building and entering almost their full length, they showed that to him, and he was astonished. He said he'd been in FBI headquarters at the time, and he had no idea the tanks were just totally smashing the building. So that much was being hidden even from headquarters FBI. And the other thing was that I mentioned some of the soundtracks that were picked up on the aircraft's audio. Well, it has a video recorder for the infrared tapes, but that also had a soundtrack you could turn on and off. And at certain points, they made the mistake of turning it on. And in one of them, the FBI commander at the scene, he's the guy in the big M1 tank, mm-hmm. is talking to the overall FBI commander at a headquarters about a mile away. And the guy at the scene is screaming for fire engines because he can see the fire spreading. And the overall commander is, who cares? And after a couple of minutes, the guy at the scene is, where are the fire engines? And the other agents are reporting there are none here. And the answer is the guy in overall command had stopped the fire engines from responding.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the guy at the scene says, where are the fire engines? The overall commander says, they're for the women and children, right? And the guy at the scene says, that's what we're trying to do. And the commander says, no one else, I hope. So,
jeez.
Yeah, he's on tape. You go to the Facebook page. I'm from the government. I'm here to kill you. You can hear the audio.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that was so disturbing to me, and probably something that most people haven't seen. I mean, I think a lot of folks that were even during that era were just kind of like, oh, it's a bunch of crazy people. Let's go about our lives. But when I was rewatching a lot of this material and just researching it, that's what was so disturbing to me, is that they were laying out what, in my opinion, was at least military tactics that you would use on a foreign enemy domestic soil. I mean, it seemed once the ATF was gone, they did bad enough. But then they rolled in the FBI. And like you said, there are a lot of special forces and other, if they're not still military contractors or retired special forces, what have you. But they're going to use those folks on domestic soil. So yeah. I don't know if it's a direct violation of posse comitatus or at least pretty bleeping close. But yeah. I mean, when you got M1 tanks rolling through buildings, you got them using psychological warfare techniques out there. And again, I can't recall the FBI head's name that was saying, oh, I don't even know what psychological warfare stuff is. I was rewatching some of this recently and I was thinking, yeah, come on, man.
Yeah.
You're playing all these disturbing sounds. You're showing lights and stuff outside. This is psychological warfare 101. You're keeping your enemy awake so that they can't get enough sleep to operate. Yeah. And sustain a normal bodily function. So what do you think that's going to do?
Yeah.
And keep in mind, there's women and children in here. This is not an occupying army. This isn't the Taliban. This isn't the Vietnamese, the Japanese, whatever you want to put on it. This is American people here in Texas.
Yeah. If I recall correctly, 2/3 of the Davidians, when they started out, were women and children, mostly older ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And of the men, I don't think a single one had had a day of military training. And one of them I know told me that Koresh took him out to teach him how to shoot. And so he fired a few rounds from a rifle. And I said, well, actually, someone else asked him the question, what type of rifle was it? He thought for a while and said, a black one. I mean, this is not exactly, you're not exactly up against commandos here. You're up against a guy who doesn't even know one type of gun from another, just their color. And they were being built up in the media to be this incredibly, you know, revolutionary, mad dog fanatic sect that probably makes the Taliban look reasonable. No, these are women and children and guys who barely know what a gun is. It was just unbelievable in that respect. And you look at the orders that were given. We're talking about the military. I got documents from Freedom of Information Act that the FBI was basically letting military contractors come out there to test out their equipment. One of them had they called it after the Get Smart series, the Cone of Silence, and somehow this would basically jam or prevent reception of all radio and television channels in the affected area. And they tested out on the divisions for like a day. And yeah, it worked. But the funniest one was they brought in a guy with two battlefield robots. And to prevent, they were going to send them right up to the Davidian house and peek in and see if the Davidian shot at them.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was, in order to prevent radio interference or jamming, the robots were little track things. They trailed out an optical cable behind themselves, and that's how they communicated. The optical cable cost $10,000 a reel. And the FBI agents in the tank kept running over it. So after the third time that they managed to cut the optical cable with their tanks, FBI basically told the guy, take your units home. We're not interested in playing with them anymore.
Hmm. Yeah, keep in mind, this technology they're using then is what they're still talking about now. And that was at least like 20-some years ago now.
27 years, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what was so disturbing to me, that these FBI agents or what have you, special forces contractors, they weren't trying to de-escalate the situation. They were taunting the people inside. They were running over the buried body. They were destroying the automobiles in the yard. They were ramming the building. They had people mooning and flipping them off and all this mess. And I'm thinking, wow, that's a great way to de-escalate a situation, guys. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were, you know, they were, it's, but the hostage rescue team is a team that is drilled and mentally oriented toward, you know, sudden dramatic action. They're not structured, or you don't choose the personalities for watching in place and de-escalating it over a period of nearly 2 months. De-escalation is just not their characteristic. Mm-hmm. So they were being put into a situation where, you know, it was exactly the opposite of their whole mindset and training. And, okay, what? Why do you need the hostage rescue team anyway? As I say, 2/3 of them are women and children. The rest mostly barely know how a gun functions. Why do you need this specialized anti-terrorist unit? Why do you need it? Hell, why do you need a SWAT team? You know, send a couple of deputies out in the squad car to keep an eye on them until they give up. But no. And the final assault was sold to Jeanette Reno on, among other things, the proposition that the hostage rescue team is losing its skills due to lack of training. Okay, well, send them off and train them. You know, we'll ask the sheriff to keep an eye on the building while they're gone.
It seemed to me like they let the frat house kind of run the university for a minute, and things just really went south.
Yeah, and this frat house had tanks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this frat house had tanks and snipers on both ends. That was another thing. They had Lon Hirucci, the same sniper from Ruby Ridge, set up out there in the field. And if you look at, they've got a crossfire, so you're really not going anywhere. They've got folks in the rear and folks in the front, and pretty much anything on either side or in the center that moves is going to get taken down. So it's not as if it was some welcome wagon. Hey, we're going to put down our weapons. If you guys want to come out, we're not going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, as I say, they could just have pulled out and left the sheriff at Sheriff Harwell, you know, let us know when they're ready to surrender. Okay. We just saved a whole lot of lives.
It seems like there was no communication with the sheriff, before they began this operation. That would have just made too much sense, I guess.
Yeah. I think the 911 was alerted that a raid was going to go down, but nothing beyond that, nothing how to reach us or anything. And so the 911 was getting all these calls, and not only the Davidians calling, but their neighbors calling in saying there's a firefight. Somebody saying there's a plane crashed, which one of the helicopters had to land. It didn't really crash. You know, that sort of thing. All this chaos because nobody prepared for anything.
Yeah. I know one of the other big question marks to a lot of people with this incident is the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like to me they were ramming these tanks through these buildings to create better airflow for a fire. I mean, I'm not a fireman nor an arson specialist or anything else, but a lot of people in my family were in the fire department, but here nor there, that's seems to be a heck of a good way to start a fire. If you want a lot of airflow for that fire to really get going, you poke a lot of holes in whatever you're trying to light on fire. So.
Oh, sure. The fire, so far as I can see, started the worst possible location. namely the second floor on the side that was facing into a very stiff wind. And so it just basically the fire took out the entire second floor, and the people who were on the first floor, including the women and children, were trapped when the upper floor began collapsing. As far as what started it, we'll never know. Now, the infrared tapes do show right at the location where it started a very hot, elongated object just outside the window. May have been a pyrotechnic tear gas grenade. For years, FBI denied that they used pyrotechnic tear gas. You got to understand, tear gas is basically breaks into two versions. The older one, pyrotechnics, expel the tear gas, which is in fact a powder, by burning a gunpowder-like mixture. Mm-hmm. And those are marked, do not use against buildings, because they also will start fires very nicely. The other ones are called ferrets. They were co-invented by a friend of mine, the late Colonel Rex Applegate, and they're more like a high-tech water balloon with the powder dissolved in a solvent, and when it hits something, it goes splat, and the solvent evaporates. FBI denied using pyrotechnics, but I figured that out a long time ago. One of my first efforts in the field, I was listening to congressional hearings, and Clive Doyle of the Davidians said we could hear the ferrets hissing under the furniture in the room. And I said to throw them out the window, and someone said they were too hot. I realized, Doyle didn't realize the significance of what he just said. Those are not ferrets. Ferrets do not hiss, and they don't get hot. That was pyrotechnic grenades going in. But as I say, those are infamous for starting fires if you use them against a building. I think the FBI ran out of ferret rounds. Well, clearly they were in short supply at the end. And in the end, they got any tear gas round they could lay their hands on and kept firing. And they pumped some ferrets in and quite likely started the fire. Or not ferrets, pyrotechnics, and quite likely started the fire.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one other element that I found so disturbing is they were using CS gas. And from the way I heard it described, it was a powder. So they used, for lack of a better term, a carrier agent, this methylene chloride, which dissolves paint and all this other stuff. And it's flammable. So, I mean, we're pumping in directly. Again, folks, women and children in a building, we're spraying it in with a huge nozzle. Oh, yeah. And then we're firing into the building. Heck, if we're just using bullets, if we're just shooting 308 rounds and 226 or whatever, if it hits something, a metal object, it's going to usually spark. And just using bullets, for Pete's sakes.
Yeah. I don't think methylene chloride is all that flammable. It may be at some level, but I don't.
I mean, I was thinking more of the CS.
CS, yeah. Well, that would give you a dust explosion, basically. The other nasty thing is methylene chloride, the carrier, if you try to look around for it, don't look in your hardware store because the government has clamped down on it as a paint thinner because it can kill you.
Wow, that was going to be my sort of caveat to this whole thing. At the very least, you probably shouldn't want to breathe this methylene chloride in. I have a feeling it's kind of toxic.
Yeah, it... metabolizes in the body to carbon monoxide, very significant levels of carbon monoxide, and it's heavier than air, so it will settle down into low-lying areas. There have been a few deaths of people who used it as paint thinner in their paint remover in their basement due to carbon monoxide. Well, if you're going to be exposed to a fire and smoke, you don't want your carbon monoxide levels already elevated before it happens. And methylene chloride will elevate them very significantly. So, you know, if you use it the way it's designed to be used in a normal police situation, like a guy's holed up in the house and you shoot in two or three of these rounds, okay, no problem. But they weren't using it in that method. They shot in hundreds of big ferret rounds, and the tanks had booms on the end of the booms. They had well, it looked like a big fire extinguisher, basically three or four big fire extinguishers. And when the tank operator pulled on a string, they would spray out like 5 pounds of methylene chloride and a CS powder into whatever was in front of them. So, you know, they were just dumping the stuff in by the gallon.
Man, that's just so sick. It really did just seem to be some huge practice exercise. I mean, you mentioned they were using the robots. They were just calling in, hey, you guys want to come train? Yeah, we're killing some American citizens in Texas. If you want to come over and do some training, it'll be great.
Well, they were, on the last day, they were out to, frankly, hornswoggle Janet Reno, who apparently was a bit squeamish about killing a bunch of people. So they contrived to send her off to a speech, and that she shouldn't skip the speech because, after all, then the American people might think there was an emergency going on. And somehow on the speech, she didn't have radio communication. I can tell you, I was working in Interior a few years before that, and if you were an assistant secretary or above, they had some manner of linking to you in the car, the official government car. That was Interior Department. It's not the Attorney General of the U.S. herself. Come on, they could reach her. And then they start in with really shellacking the building while she's, you know, while the cat's away, the mice will play. And by the end of it, they're getting desperate because they figured the Davidians would come running out the minute they put the tear gas in. What's going on? They aren't coming out. What the heck is going on? Obviously, they're not going to be coming out, and we've dumped in as much tear gas as we humanly can. I mean, we're running out of this stuff, and they still haven't come out, and when the Attorney General gets back, we're going to look real stupid. So maybe they, you know, made use of the pyrotechnic grenades for a reason. Got to get them out one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good name there. What role do you think Reno was really playing in all this? Because I've heard sort of contemporaneously with this, you had the Whitewater scandal, and perhaps this was sort of a diversionary tactic from what was going on with Bill and Hillary with the Whitewater scandal. I've sort of heard conjecture that Reno was in many ways behind all this and trying to pull strings here. I don't know. What's your thoughts on it?
I think Janet Reno in the Waco episode was being swindled. I mean, she wasn't real close to Bill Clinton when she came in.
Mm-hmm.
Webster Hubbell, her, I believe he was her associate attorney general, nominally below her in the chain of command, but in fact, he has personal ties to Bill and Hillary Clinton from when they were practicing in the same law firm. So it looks like the chain of Waco command actually went from Bill and Hillary to Webster Hubbell, bypassing Janet Reno. Only at the end was she brought in. And like I say, Webster Hubbell was the guy giving the actual orders to FBI. And she was swindled. You can see the briefing when they're trying to get her to authorize the tear gassing. And, you know, they're striving to push her every button. They're making sure she doesn't know that Koresh has already talked about coming out. There is no hope for them coming out voluntarily, she is told. And you can sign off on this plan because we'll just insert a little tear gas. We'll only insert all of it if they shoot. Okay, now it's easy enough. You arrange for Lon Horiushi to... the moment the tanks go forward, radio with the word compromise, which means somebody has started shooting. Okay, now you inject all the gas you want.
So he was the one that was sort of given the we're under attack again orders?
Yep, the word was compromise. Yeah, and I don't know if there was firing or not from the Davidian side. I know that some of the surviving Davidians have told me essentially, we're not stupid enough to have thought you could stop a tank by shooting it with an ordinary rifle. Okay.
Yeah.
You'd have to be mighty stupid to think that.
So what was Lon Herucci's play in this? Was he just sort of there, much like Ruby Ridge, sort of playing cleanup?
Well, all I know is that he was at one of the sniper positions, and it's reported that his voice is the one you hear on the radio saying, compromise, compromise. I haven't been able to verify that is his voice, but that is the report anyway.
So it sounds like it must have been Webster Hubble that was sort of leading this from D.C., and they were just feeding Reno some bad intel and essentially letting her be the fall guy for this.
Yeah. And there is some word, I'm trying to remember specifics, that who was the fellow who committed suicide in the Clinton White House?
Vince Foster, another Rose Law firm.
That Vince Foster and Webster Hubble were in communication over Waco, and that Vince Foster took very hard all the deaths that occurred. So, you know, that again, the chain of command was outside what you'd expect. It wasn't president to attorney general, president and first lady to associate attorney general, bypassing Jeanette Reno.
Yeah, it sounds like the Clintons were keeping everything pretty close to the vest with all their Rose Law Firm chums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, if you want to keep something quiet, use your buddies or your own private email server.
That is the truth. Well, another big part of this that you see sort of in every single event that's taken place after this is the crime scene's destroyed and all this evidence is lost. I don't know where it is. We 9/11, we shipped all the steel to China. We cleaned it up. You know, every single shooting, false flag or otherwise, hey, the crime scene's gone.
Yeah.
Oh, where's the school in Connecticut? Oh, we tore it down. It's gone.
Oh, Waco was exceptional there. First of all, they did search the crime scene. But the strange part is the Davidians had a big double front door.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those that's made out of basically stamped sheet metal with wooden frame inside. And throughout the siege, the Davidians were taunting the FBI that one half of it, I forget whether it was left or the right, one half of it would prove they had not started the firefight because all the bullet holes through it were coming into the building, not going out. And, you know, after the fire, that half of the door vanished. Mm-hmm. The other half survived. I've seen it with my own eyes. That half of the door just somehow from a tightly controlled crime scene, which was searched using tapes so that you would have a grid of 1 yard marking each area and you know where you found some. That door just must have flown away. And the other thing was, after they were done picking over the crime scene, they got somebody in the state Department of Environmental Quality or something to rule that the site was a hazardous waste site due to all the expended bullets. And so they literally bulldozed the ground. I mean, demolished everything and then literally bulldozed up the earth. And I assume took it off to a toxic waste dump. So, yeah, one of the more thorough cases of wiping out evidence I've ever heard of. In fact, the most thorough.
Yeah, I can't recall the gentleman's name, but I was watching this kind of recently as I was preparing for this. But I think it was someone from the medical examiner or whatnot was just filming the area, sort of in the process of the cleanup and sort of noting where the... that wasn't a grain silo, I guess, maybe like a water tower and the whatever the remnants of the site were. And they confiscated the tape. And of course, they just couldn't get the tape back. We lost it. We don't know where it is. We have no chain of custody. We have no chain of evidence. I don't know. It's just like a library book. I don't know where it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was that. There was, trying to think. Oh, the other evidence that vanished was the deceased Davidians were being stored in a refrigerator. The bodies were being stored in a refrigerated trailer, and somehow the power went off.
Grave. I didn't know that.
Coincidences, inside coincidences. When I started to sue ATF over the Freedom of Information Act, they admitted they had, I believe, 4 cameras trained on the Davidian house at the moment the raid went down, and they couldn't find a single videotape from any of them. And finally, they coughed up one. And I went back to the court and said, this is supposedly the only videotape. You can see 3 other agents with video cams, okay? This is not the only videotape. So they coughed up one more and said, that's it. And I took from the second one, I said, print it out in black and white. Didn't have colored printers back then. Attached it to my pleadings and said, in this video, you can see 2 other agents holding cameras. And they responded, no, they're both the same agent, and it's the one we already gave you. So at that point, I went out, and they were expensive, but I got color copies and attached them and filed that in court and said, if you look, it wasn't apparent from black and white, but if you look in color, one of the agents is visibly African American. The other agent is, you see his arm, he's almost albino white. Mm-hmm. So unless this man has had a strange arm transplant, these are 2 different people.
Yeah.
And then they finally coughed up another tape. So.
Wow, I didn't know that at all. That's totally insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The judge thought so too.
The missing tape must be somewhere where the Jeffrey Epstein tape is and the tape from the Pentagon lawn, because they're all missing too. It's just funny.
Yeah.
That's what's so silly, is they expect the American public to believe that when they run these operations or at these different facilities, there's nothing, they're not doing any filming. Of course they do.
Yeah.
They want to, if nothing else, CYA. So they're going to film these operations going on.
How unfortunate that the cameras failed at the wrong moment. Yeah, sure.
Wow. Well, that one's news to me. I didn't know that one. So I guess connecting the dots, I mean, how do you see all this playing out as to where we are today? Because I sort of keep looking back at this decade. It's so relevant because, you know, you got the red flag gun laws, you got the Bundy Ranch siege, you got the Lavoie Finicum getting gunned down. So to me, it was just kind of a warm-up decade where they were kind of seeing what they could push the envelope and move that Overton window a bit, and now we're seeing that.
Oh, yeah. You've seen the Overton window shifted quite decisively in those terms. And in a way, it's interesting that now all of a sudden the left is starting to realize, hey, wait a minute. I look at what the left is talking about today is like, well, they arrest people with unmarked cars. Going, where were you guys at Waco?
Okay. Yeah.
100 dead. They weren't arresting people with unmarked cars. Stop losing, experiencing bladder incontinence due to stress over this little thing and worry about the decade that you spent building it up and supporting all of this. I mean, yeah, Ruby Ridge. Yeah. Okay, so a few people got killed. They were sort of right-wing anyway. Waco, same thing. Actually, it's not clear David Koresh was right-wing or left-wing or anything else. You know, he's often a religious world, not worrying about politics. Anything else? So, as long as you're doing it to conservatives and right-wing, that's okay by us. We don't worry. Yeah. Then they wind up arresting somebody using an unmarked car, and all the leftists running around in circles screaming their heads off. Hey, guys, you brought a lot worse than this on yourself.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, they had someone infiltrate the group and everything, and they sort of knew the gig was up when they were doing the raid. Somehow word got back to the Davidians, and they knew what was coming, and they could have called the whole thing off. They could have said, hey, you know, so my coach blew the whistle. We're going to run this play again. And they know we're coming.
Yep. That was Robert Rodriguez. He was sent in as an undercover agent from the undercover house to the Davidian place. And the truth of the matter was the Davidians knew he was undercover. They just didn't know which agency.
Mm-hmm.
And we know about that because during the firefight, Koresh got on the line to 911. He has no other source of information right now. I mean, the battle is still going on. The media hasn't covered it. And he's been wounded. And one of the things he says is, if you'd come out here peacefully, I would have showed you the records on all of our guns. We have all the right paperwork. And he says, that's what I told Robert Rodriguez. You know, Robert, the guy you sent out here. He knew he was an agent all along. And in the beginning, just before the raid, Rodriguez goes over there. He is present when Koresh gets a telephone call telling him the raid is coming. And he goes to Robert, and Robert is really worried. I mean, you're an undercover agent. They may suspect it. And you're right there as they know the raid is incoming. And Koresh just shakes his hand and says something to the effect of, best wishes, and sends Robert home. Well, Robert, of course, goes trotting back to the undercover house and tries to call up the ATF top dogs and say, stop the raid. They know. And he can't reach one who's willing to stop the raid. I mean, the bottom line is this was going to be the big PR expedition of the year. This was going to set up their, appropriations battle. Nobody wanted to be the guy who would say, stop it, something's gone wrong, go back and plan. That would be a career ender. So the raid went ahead.
That's just so sad. It's just so ridiculous that this whole thing could have been avoided.
Oh, yeah.
And I always look at these events kind of as a big multi-pronged attack. And this is another one that I keep hearing and sort of seeing become prevalent in why this was carried out, is it seemed to be another attack on, if you want to call it, the Patriot movement that was going on in that early 90s era. I mean, yeah. I think Ruby Ridge was sort of death nail one in that coffin, and this one perhaps two. If you want to go to Oklahoma City, that's probably three, where they were trying to quell any sort of uprising of, hey, we should probably have our constitutional rights and, we're not being violent here, but we believe in the Bill of Rights, Constitution, peace, justice, the American way. And they were trying to quell any sort of embers of that actually taking hold in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There was very definitely that trend over that period, which again makes it so amusing today when, all of a sudden you have coming from the left, outright anarchy, turning entire areas of a city into basically an anarchic state. And all of a sudden, the left is mostly peaceful demonstrations. Yeah, I suppose you could call caving in a window and looting a shop a demonstration. I don't know what you're demonstrating, though. Yeah,
I always kind of just liken it to rebranding. They can just rebrand whatever to their liking. It's not the Department of War. It's the Department of Defense. And we're not terrorists. We're protesters, I tell you. That's it. We're protesting.
Yeah. Yeah, we're protesting as we set fire to things. Hey, that's one way to protest, I suppose.
It's kind of another odd parallel I was noticing as I was researching this more recently, is it seemed to take on like this bizarre carnival atmosphere outside of the Waco thing. During this 51-day siege, it was kind of reminiscent of all this stupid CHOP or CHAZ or whatever they've become, and all these different Antifa movements where it's just sort of like, hey, it's a big party. It's like Woodstock 3. We're all out here watching the feds shoot at people. We're all out here burning buildings and breaking stuff. Yeah. And I mean, I guess it's kind of similar. I heard tale of this in the Civil War. They'd sort of sit out on the lawn and, oh, look at the troops fighting in the distance there. And I'm like,
oh, yeah,
that's sort of morose, guys. Come on. Like, why would you bring your kid to this?
Yeah. They tried to do it from a safe distance, but it didn't always work out that way, as at the first Battle of Bull Run, When part of the problem with moving the Union troops back was all the dang spectators and their coaches on the same roads you need to use.
Well, is there anything we can take away from all this?
Yeah, watch your back. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just, you know, the reason I wrote the book was I'd practiced both in private practice and government work for 45 years. And I thought it was grossly unfair, the burdens that the law puts on anyone who wants to sue the government. It's just so plainly the deck stacked, mostly by the courts themselves, not by Congress. The deck is stacked so firmly in favor of the government on the rationale that unless you let the government kill you by negligence, well, we'd have to shut the place down. Well, who would run a company on that basis? I mean, if General Motors said, unless we're allowed to kill people by negligence, we'd have to shut down, everyone would say, then shut down. But that's what led me to come out with the book. And I hope people can take lessons away from it.
Beyond the headline and all the hoopla, what actually became of those poor folks that actually survived this? Do you have any idea? Because I saw some of this in the hearings and the trial footage and everything like that. But, I mean, it was just so startling and just horrible. I can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. I remember one of the gentlemen talking about the children and everybody just burning alive. I mean, that's what was going on here. It's hard to reconcile that. I think the average citizen, it's hard to reconcile that. But, yo, this happened here on our soil.
Oh, yeah.
By our government. And that's, I think, one big disconnect that I always have, because I'm not here to lionize nor demonize police or law enforcement or military, but you often hear this argument, oh, well, the government would never come house to house and take your weapons, or oh, they'd never kill you in the street and take all your... And I'm thinking, did you guys miss the whole 90s decade? Did you miss Ruby Ridge and Waco? I mean, not only will they have. They'll do it again. Lavoie Finicum, Bundy Ranch siege. It's not a matter of will they do it. To my opinion, is when they'll do it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Davidians, I've been to a few of their memorial ceremonies, and they're still mostly centered, as nearly as I can see, around Waco. Somebody left them some money, and so they rebuilt a small church there. And the interesting part is, outside the church, they have a monument to their dead, of course. They also have a monument to the six ATF agents who were killed in the raid.
That's impressive.
Yeah, they're a forgiving type. These are the guys who are supposed to be these mad dog fanatics. No. Yeah. They will even turn the other cheek.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back then, even when I was in high school there, that was sort of part of that media manipulation spin. Even then, it was like the Branch Davidians. It's these crazy people. It's Jim Jones. It's only in Texas now. We got to go snuff them out. It was... Mm-hmm. Oh, he's a child molester, and there's all this abuse going on. And too nice to know at the time, but I mean, a lot of that just wasn't accurate.
No. You know, they, so far as I can see, they believed, yes, that we are in the end times, approaching the second coming of Christ. But their definition of the end times was a very long process. One stage of it alone would take 10,000 years. So it's not like the world is going to end tomorrow. In 10 or 20,000 years, And they were debating which of the seven seals we were in. Now I forget the consensus, but it's sort of funny because one of the sign of the next seal being opened is a massive earthquake. And so at one point, Koresh sends out a note to the FBI that you've got a lot of your men camping in an area below an earthen dam, big earthen dam. I'd recommend you move them to higher ground because I think there's going to be an earthquake. This is Koresh. You know, no sense getting your guys drowned. Get them in the high ground just in case. Mm-hmm. Very considerate of him.
And yeah, the way things are looking now, I don't think they're too far off, but
yeah.
We've kicked the can down the road a whole lot further since that horrible incident.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like we could talk about this for a long time. This has been great. We got to talk about some of your other books and some of your Second Amendment work as well sometime.
Yeah, sounds good to me. Sure.
Was there any parting message you'd like to leave people as far as it goes with this incident? I know that they can find out a lot of information I didn't even know about. You got these extra audio tapes that seem quite interesting on your Facebook site, right?
Facebook, yep. It's for the book, and I'm from the government, and I'm here to kill you. Go on Facebook and look for audio and video, the audio and video link. You'll find them there. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, I'll have all those links and more available on the website under your guest media section in case anybody's out there jotting down this in the car at the gym. Yeah. I guess you can't be at the gym anymore without a mask, so that's impossible now, but on the off chance you are out of your house without a mask and listening to this, fear not, it will be available at anomicgage.com.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you again. And if you hold on for a second, I'll talk to you off air after I wrap this up.
Oh, sure.
All right. Thank you. I want to thank everyone once again for tuning in to the Anomic Age today. As I said a moment ago, you can find all the information from this guest and all others at anomicage.com. We'll have the video and the audio links there for your convenience. Until next time, as I always close with, you can't do everything, but you can do something. So please get out there and try to make a difference and do your part out there. Till next time, I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go to bed.